Everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday, March 2nd, 2022. And thank you for joining us for the 125th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. So this show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you very much for that. And if you would, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
The name of the song is called When. And it's really about what do you do when you're born with differences, and what does that mean for your life, and how are you going to live it, and what are you going to do with that? And as is so often the case in these little side tracks that I take, it's a self-portrait. It's one of my tunes.
Excellent. All right. That's fantastic. Thank you very much for that. I always kind of get a kick out of when you have the ones that you've written yourself, because it's a nice little surprise, and they blend right in.
There you
okay.
go.
Okay. Yeah. So, as Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled The Kids Are All Right, Giftedness, Autism, and ADHD, which we will get to discussing in a moment. Before we begin our topic discussion, though, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So I thought I'd do something a little different this evening. When you look at the world of classic music that was released back in the day, you have a lot of people who argue, oh, this was a great year, that was a great year, oh, you know. But what I have found in my own minuscule research is that for some reason, 71 seemed to be a really crazy release year for rock records. And I thought I would talk about all of the major records, many of which have now become just classic records. They were just released, you know, as like, okay, well, this is our next record kind of thing. Would have gone on to become really rock icons that were released all in 71. And so I'm going to start off, and I'm going to talk about them in order of release because I can. Okay. So the first one I'm going to mention is the third album by Chicago Transit Authority, which by this time was now called Chicago, because they were sued by the Chicago Transit Authority. And you would think that, you know, a band that's trying to, yeah, I mean, you'd think that a band that's trying to advertise their home city and, you know, it's like, come on, really? Anyway, Chicago 3 got released early in that year, and that was followed very closely by Hooker in Heat, which was the Canned Heat record that was in tribute to their lost brother who recently had died. Uriah Heep's record Salisbury was released there. And then the very first album by ZZ Top was released, which has become kind of an iconic thing, particularly in light of the passing of their bassist recently. Janis Joplin's Pearl was released in 71, early in the year. And the Yes album by the band Yes was also released. Long Player by The Faces, which would be one of the last records that Rod Stewart would have with them, was released. And later on, Tapestry, which has become one of Carole King's like hallmark records, was released that year. Hendrix released a semi-compilation record called The Cry of Love, which had a bunch of stuff that he recorded with Billy Miles and some with his regular drummer, Mitch Mitchell, who came back right after that. Humble Pie's Rock On was released, which was their last record with Peter Frampton, other than the live record they would release later that year. That was the last studio record that had Peter Frampton on it before Clem Clemson from Coliseum came and joined them. Probably one of the biggest records in terms of reaching superstardom that was released that year was Jethro Tull's Aqualung, which is definitely one of my favorite records of all times and arguably in the top 25, like, ever. Likewise, the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East was also released, which was one of their first live recording that featured Duane Allman, and that was done right before Eat a Peach, which was the last record he recorded with them before his untimely death. Paul McCartney released his second record, Ram, which caught a lot of flack back in the day when it was released, in part due to the fact that John Lennon had friends at Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much trashed the record. but it has since become considered to be one of Paul's better solo releases. It was his second release after his first one, McCartney. The Doors released their last record with Jim Morrison, L.A. Woman, that year. And then shortly following that, one of my, probably my absolute favorite Rolling Stones record, Sticky Fingers, was released. And for those who don't know, that's the record that contains Brown Sugar on it that has the front cover of the pants with the zipper on it, or if you were in England, the trousers with the zipper on it. And that, for those who don't know, that album cover was designed by Andy Warhol.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So right after that, Thin Lizzy releases their first record, self-titled, and the Doobie Brothers released their first record, self-titled. The James Gang releases their last studio record with Joe Walsh, Thirds, which contains Walk Away, which is probably their best-known recording. Graham Nash of CSNN and CSNNY releases his first solo record, Songs for Beginners, which I love. I think that's a great record. For those folks who've not heard it, it's got some really good tunes off of it. Recently, having departed his band, blues trio band Taste, Rory Gallagher releases his first solo record, just called Rory Gallagher. And Rod Stewart releases his first record, Every Picture Tells a Story, which has Maggie May off of it, which has, you know, since become a bazillion-selling song. Tarkus is then released by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer that year, which is a great record for folks who don't know that. And probably the most well-known record by Joni Mitchell was released, and I think Rolling Stones has labeled this in, like, the top 10 best records of all times. Blue was released right after Tarkus. Shortly after that, the Moody Blues released their record, Every Good Boy Deserves Favor. Shortly thereafter, Deep Purple releases Fireball. It has just a number of gigantic hits off of it. Jack Bruce releases a solo record, Harmony Row, which I think was his third since departing Cream. His first record, Songs for a Tailor, have my all-time favorite Jack Bruce song on it, which is Theme from an Imaginary Western, that if anybody knows that song, they probably know Mountain's version of it, which is amazing. And when I hear Leslie West solo on that record that he plays at Woodstock Live, I still get chill bumps and cry. I mean, it's amazingly emotional. I just love that flippin' song, the way he plays it. Not to mention the fact that Leslie's one of my all-time favorite guitar heroes, but he just does a masterful job on that solo, in my opinion. The seminal Master of Reality by Black Sabbath is released. And in that particular album, they had had, because Tony Iommi's fingers were still bothering him, they actually tuned some of the guitars songs down a whole step and a half down to kind of ease up the tension on the strings and really created some super heavy sounds for that record, and it has really gotten a lot of airplay. 10 years after release, A Space in Time on it, which I think has I'd Love to Change the World off of it, if I'm not mistaken. And then probably, if not the best, one of the best non-concept albums recorded by The Who was released, Who's Next?, which was taken in part from songs that were abandoned from the Lighthouse Project, which was supposed to be a rock opera that Pete Townsend sort of abandoned, and they took a lot of songs off of it and used them in Who's Next. Fleetwood Mac releases Future Games, and this is the old-school Fleetwood Mac, not the new Fleetwood Mac, the pop version of Fleetwood Mac, and I'm not slamming, I'm just describing him, because Fleetwood Mac started out, for those who don't know, Fleetwood Mac started out as a blues band and a blues rock band. They were not the glitzy, you know, Lindsey Buckingham, Stevie Nicks, you know, hit-making machine band. Three Dog Night releases Harmony, which I think has an old-fashioned love song off of it, which was written not by them. In fact, they didn't do a lot of songs written by them. They did a lot of Paul Williams songs, and old-fashioned love song happens to be one of them. Uriah Heep releases Look at Yourself, which has a lot of their good hits of it. Free, Paul Rodgers' original band that he came to fame with, and Simon Kirk, the drummer, who are still with Free to this day, excuse me, with a bad company, because when Free dissolves, Simon Kirk and Paul Rogers form Bad Company. Free Live is released, and Santana releases Santana 3. The James Gang release their live album, James Gang Rides Again, which is definitely their last release with James, with Joe Walsh at the Live Records. Really good record for folks who aren't familiar with that. They do a great version of the Yardbirds' Lost Woman off of it. It is really good. John Lennon releases his seminal album, Imagine, which has the title track by the same name, which is probably his most well-known song. Cat Stevens, one of my all-time favorite acoustic heroes, releases Teaser and the Firecat. Hawkwind releases In Search of Space. The Doors released their post-Jim Morrison album, Other Voices, which is frankly one of my all-time favorite Doors records. I am not a Jim Morrison freak. I know most people are going to go, but I really despised him, frankly. No offense. He was not my cup of tea. And I love that record. It got a lot of not good accolades in the day, but I love that record. Pink Floyd released Metal. And REO Speedwagon released their first record by the same name, and that's pre-Kevin Cronin, because he was not the original vocalist, for folks who don't know that. So if you listen to Riding the Storm Out, that's got a different vocalist on it, the studio recording of that. The all-time multi-jillion dollar record, American Pie by Don McLean, gets released. And a then unknown pianist, singer, songwriter, Billy Joel, releases Cold Spring Harbor, his first recording. Elton John, another piano songwriter, but by this time very well known, releases Madman Across the Water. Genesis releases Nursery Crime, which I think is their first recording with Phil Collins doing a lot of this, taking over the role that was vacated by their former lead vocalist. Fragile releases Yes, which is, I think, their first Rick Wakeman record. Rory Gallagher releases his second recording, Deuce. Traffic releases The Low Spark of High Heel Boys, a studio recording.
Oh.
And Humble, yeah, great record. And Humble Pie releases another freaking great live record, Rocking the Fillmore, which is their last recording with Peter Frampton. Nazareth releases their first album by the same name, Nazareth. And for folks who don't have that record, it's really good. They've got some really good blues, rocky stuff, Scottish-y blues rocky stuff. Carly Simon releases her seminal record, Anticipation. And probably the biggest record, or one of the biggest records that year, Led Zeppelin IV gets released, the Zoso record, as I like to call it. And I think a lot of people refer to it as that. Following on the wheels of that, the Electric Light Orchestra released their first record called The Electric Light Orchestra. What a catchy title. And Paul McCartney's new band, since the Beatles, Wings, released Wildlife. King Crimson releases the record Islands. The Apple-sponsored band Bad Company released Straight Up, which is a fantastic record. Carole King tries to capture her early glory in a release that didn't do as well as Tapestry, but she releases Music. The band America releases their first record, America, which is also a fabulous effort. And they catch a lot of slack for being a CSN copy band, but I think they're really good on their own right, frankly. And probably one of my all-time favorite live records, and certainly the live concert that started most benefits, the concert for Bangladesh by George Harrison and friends. And that got released, I think, on the last day of December or close to it. It didn't get released in Europe till the following year, early January, but it got released in this country the end of December that year. And for those who haven't heard that, it is un-freaking-believable. It's a who's who of just about everybody who was anybody back in the day when that was done, including Eric Clapton, the band Badfinger, Billy Preston, Leon Russell, Bob Dylan. I mean, it's it is definitely a who's who of holy molies on there. He's just got Jim Keltner, Ringo Starr, Ravi Shankar opens up and does a whole thing. It's freaking fabulous. Folks who have not heard that record, that you have lived under a rock. And if you have, come out of the rock and buy that record. It's freaking fabulous. It's really, really, really good. Okay, so those are the things that got released, rock-oriented things that got released in 1971, and that's why I think that was an amazingly stellar year for rock music.
Very cool. All righty. Thank you very much for all that.
Sure.
I was actually thinking about the year thing when you mentioned that. Do you suppose that this extreme blossoming of the industry had anything to do with Vietnam winding down?
I suspect so. It was kind of comes on the tail movement of the free love hippie movement and the disillusionment
right.
of the hippie movement with, Charles Manson, which is the won't get fooled, part of the impetus of won't get fooled again on who's next. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know, but there was a whole lot of creativity going on in the 70s, I'm telling you what. And, having grown up as a young person, as a very young person during that time, I didn't really appreciate how awesome, because it was just normal. I mean, it was so much good music coming out, you just kind of went, okay, yeah, that's another good band, so what?
You took it for granted, yeah.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, I should be bitch smacked for that. But yes, I took that for granted, and especially now you hear the stuff coming out today, and no offense, because there are some artists that are really stellar. But by and large, the music today kind of pales in comparison, which is why most of the folks that I see, the adolescents and young adults I see, are listening to their dad's or grandfather's music or whatever, or the older brother's music, and going, yeah, dude, the music today, like, bites. So it's
well,
so interesting.
That's how you got to be the rock and roll straight.
Yeah, well, it's so funny having these kids come in and go, dude, I heard your show and you were playing Hendrix. Oh, my God. I've got a
wow.
couple of kids who like, I know, I was blown away. I have a couple of folks that I see who go, yeah, that point you made about addictions on your show really, really hit hard. And I was really thinking, I'm like, you've heard the radio show? I'm like, holy
shoes.
That's shoes.
Awesome. So I guess we'll have to behave ourselves now. Hi, guys.
No.
Yeah,
okay. That's one of the, it's kind of funny because that's one of the things that most of the folks that hear my show go, I love the fact that you're just you on the show. You're the same. I said, yeah, crazy MF-er than I am in here. And they start laughing. I go, yeah, I'm weird everywhere I go. That never changes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think both of us are like that. It's like, this is what you get all the time. This is not a special put on. We're acting this crazy.
It is not, to quote Pete Townsend, it is not an eminence front.
It's the
real deal, yeah.
Totally
I've had several people. I have a couple of parents of the kids that I see go, wow, I really liked your radio show. I'm like, holy moly. And I went,
nice.
Freaked out. They go, no, we kind of expected it. It's you. I'm like, okay, well, I'm feeling much better now.
Great, if anybody is listening, is we would love to hear from you guys on topics that, maybe we haven't touched on enough, to help you, or if there's something on your mind or whatever. I kind of draw topics from social media or things that people I know are going through, or if that doesn't provide anything, I'll grab something I'm going through. But, I did not quite realize there were that many people listening. I sort of knew because I watched the board. Like, after we do the episode, it will convert it and then host it as an MP3. So it's a file. You can just download it, or you can even play
right.
it on the website. And
right.
after a few hours, it will tell you, how many people either came to listen to it live or went to it afterwards. So listen to it as a file or download it. And I never know where they're coming from. I just know that people stop by, so I have no idea what
right.
they did. But that's
well,
good
at
to
least
know.
Some of them are folks that I'm working with. So I honestly, that really—I mean, I joke about it a lot, but that really did take me by surprise. I was flabbergasted.
Well, that's excellent. Welcome to them, and you know, please let us know what else we can do. So,
yeah, absolutely.
All right.
And any of you folks out there that hear these things live or listen to them after the fact, if you have any ideas for shows or questions you have, please send them in, because we would love to try to address some of your stuff. It would be make our job a lot easier.
Yes, yes. You can send them a message to the Facebook page, or also Dr. Mathis's general consumption email address is up on the Rock and Roll Strength website. So you can get it from there as well and contact us that way and let us know what you want to hear about. So, all right, with that, let's go ahead and start diving in. So we'll take calls from any listeners that are out there live and questions in the online chat room throughout the rest of the evening until around midnight. It's 11:25, so we've got a little over a half hour left to talk. Feel free to give us a call. And again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay, episode 125, The Kids Are All Right, Giftedness, Autism, or ASD. Autism. Yeah, it is ASD. Sorry, we just did the antisocial one, so I'm getting my abbreviations all mushed together. Because we got ASD and ADHD and all this stuff. It's a lot of abbreviations. Goodness. Okay, so tonight's topic was born from a meme that was going around social media, primarily Facebook and Twitter. It was originally a tweet, and people copied it and pasted it everywhere. And it's been the last couple of weeks where I have seen it. I don't know how old it actually is because I have misplaced the original meme. I thought that I had posted it, but I haven't been able to find it. So I'm going to paraphrase for you basically what it said. It was a tweet that said, "Gifted kids, how long did it take you before you were also diagnosed with either ADHD or ASD?" And so at first glance, there appears to be some manner of connection between giftedness and either ADHD or ASD, sometimes both. There is significant correlation, but we all know correlation is not causality, so we want to look into this a little more. We want to investigate and discuss the potential causality of things or the lack thereof. So tonight we will discuss what precisely is giftedness when we talk about it, basically high IQ. And I may read a small snip from an NIH study on this. It's long and it's super crunchy, but what I want to read to you is the term that they're using instead and why they're not calling it giftedness. And so anyway, we're going to talk about that, how it gets tested and found today. Possible flaws and social biases in IQ testing. There have been quite a few objections over the last couple of decades about the original way that this was done, and some tests have been shifted. Dr. Mathis will bring up some stuff on some of these tests. I've taken them, but I've never administered one. So, also the prevalence of ADHD or ASD or both in gifted persons versus NT, neurotypical, gifted awkwardness, just the awkwardness of being a kid and being different. And if you're super different, sometimes you get super awkward. You know, is that a sign of anything, or is that just awkwardness because you're outside the lines? You know, we'll talk about that in closing remarks. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you real quick, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything that you'd like to add before we dive in.
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. So first, and this show, like some of the last few, is not heavily scripted. So we're just going to talk extempore about these things. So I want to talk about what precisely is giftedness or high IQ and how it's tested and found today. So first, if I could get you to talk about what giftedness is or having a high IQ and what it's not. There's sometimes misperceptions about what we're measuring and why that matters. So is that something that you could kind of explain to our laypeople audience for us?
It's funny because I went over this last night on a test results conference I did on somebody that I tested. Because as you know, I do a lot of testing. I do all the testing for all three offices I'm affiliated with because I'm the only dedicated guy who likes to do this stuff. And really, it's like I was telling the person I was testing in the family, it's not that I like doing the testing or I like torturing people for 12 hours, but I like the data I get because it really gives me a pragmatic snapshot into how somebody's brain works. So first of all, let's talk about what this is, and that's a great place for us to start. So in general, first of all, let's talk about IQ because it's really a misnomer. So when this whole concept started, this all started with Alfred Binet back in the day when he was doing his experiments and studies on how French school children learned back in the day. And because his work and the work of Jean Piaget came to the public awareness and to the awareness of the French education department and the government, they gave Alfred Binet a grant to try to set up some sort of testing device or assessment tools to figure out different mental skill sets so that they could morph education for certain students, whether they were on the lower end or the higher end, that needed a different kind of education and really is the start of our quote-unquote special education movement. And it all started in France. And Binet took the money and hired some medical school interns to help him and residents to help him with the testing and stuff. So he worked on it, developed the test, ran the subject pools and all, and came out with a set of testing materials called the Binet Scales of Mental Abilities, which measure different skill sets in different areas. So you fast forward several years, and Goddard and Terman, who were two psychologists working out of Stanford University in America, in California, got wind of this and said, wow, we need something like that in America. And they contacted the Binet estate and the government, French government, and said, hey, would you be willing to schlep us the data from the stuff and the tests and all so that we can do translations and morph it to an educational system here in America? Because as most of you know, the European system is very different from ours. So they went, sure, and they sent them the data, and Stanford University foot the bill for the folks for Goddard and Terman to run the groups and do the whole thing. So years later, they finished their stuff, and they published the first test. And they called it the Stanford, for Stanford University, Binet, for Alfred Binet, IQ test. And in our lovely American narcissism, we've taken this test that was supposed to measure different types of mental skill sets or abilities and turned it into an intelligence test, which it was never intended to be. Okay? So that's problem number one. Rob, yeah, we might, Houston, we might have a problem. Problem number two, so then David Wechsler comes along and says, hey, I want a test that measures slightly different types of mental abilities than Stanford Binet and make it more academically oriented. And so he comes out with the Wechsler Scales of Intelligence, and he has a child version, a child adolescent version. He has a little kid version and an adult version. So the WPSI, the Wechsler Preschool and Primary Scale of Intelligence, the WISC, the Wechsler Intelligence Scale for Children, and the WAIS, the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale. So he keeps the term intelligence, right? Mistake number 14,000. Anyway, so he comes out with the Wechsler tests, and the two standards in America to test this thing we call IQ is either the Wechsler or the Stanford Binet. To this day. Now, they're on iteration number 9,453 1/3 or whatever. The Wechslers are up to their version 5 in some cases and version 4 in other cases. And I don't know what the Stanford Binet is up to because I stopped using Stanford Binet a long time ago. Stanford Binet is a great test if you're trying to measure either, you know, an echinoderm's IQ. Very, 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 very low. Or you're trying to measure, you know, Mycroft, Sherlock Holmes' smarter brother's IQ, very, 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 very high. It's not as good or efficient as the Wechsler is for everybody else, which is most of us folks here. Okay? So that's why I use the Wexler predominantly.
When does Wexler come out, if I may interrupt?
Yeah.
Oh, when did the Wexler come out as a test that was used out in the wild?
The Wexler and the Stanford ME came out like in the 40s.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
40s, 50s, and it's been. I don't.
They gave
to be
me
honest
the Stanford
with
Binet, but the Wexler was an option. They just didn't do it.
Yeah. So exactly. The Wexler came after the Stanford Binet, right? I use the Wexler just because it's shorter and it's more relevant to the general population and the folks that I work with. So I use the Wexler exclusively. But I tell everybody, we can't even as a group of people, as a group of mental health professionals, whether psychiatrists, psychologists, whatever, we can't even completely agree what this thing called intelligence is. So if you can't identify a construct and operationalize it, how in the blue blazes can you get a test that measures it? Well, you can't. So what does IQ really measure? It measures school-related abilities and jobs that reinforce the same kinds of tasks that the school trains you to do. So it's predominantly, it's particularly, let's talk about the Wexler, it's very heavily laden in information database, short-term, long-term memory, abstract synthetic reasoning, also known as executive functioning, and verbal skills and auditory processing skills. And it's not going to tell how good of a musician you're going to be. It's not going to tell how great an Olympic athlete you're going to be, or a taxi cab driver, or a haute couture person, or a, you know, gourmet chef, or a cab driver, or a bricklayer, or an architect necessarily. Now, there's some math in there, but the math in the IQ test is not really math. It's word problems that you have to do in your head. So it's really not math. It's really auditory short-term memory and auditory number digit manipulation. So it really doesn't measure arithmetic at all. quote Andy Rooney. Right. So to quote Andy Rooney, it doesn't measure arithmetic at all.
Oh, my God.
You got to love that guy.
That's
anyway.
One of the things I was wondering, because a lot of people would complain that a lot of these tests don't measure things that are – intellectual
they're misnamed, right? So that's really what an IQ test is. So what an IQ test is, at least the Wexler, is like 17 subtests that measure different aspects of how your brain processes data. It's a mental abilities test, right? So call it a frickin' mental abilities test and not an IQ test, please, okay? So that's what it is. So to be gifted, now back to your original question, in order to be gifted, at least in America, right, you have to reach a certain cutoff point. The average IQ of every person, regardless of age, gender, sexual orientation, whatever, the 68 to 69% of the population, right, the average, the mean, right, the normal, hence the normal curve, right, is an IQ score, a standardized IQ score of between 90 and 110, with 100 being the mean. So in general, if you're over 115, which is a standard deviation and a half above the mean, because it's a 10-point thing for one standard deviation. So if 115 is considered high average, and anything over 120 is considered gifted. Anything over 130, 135, depending on what state you're in, depending on who you talk to, it's considered quote unquote genius. And if you're over, I think 140, you get invited to sit for Mensa, or 145 in some places. And so think of giftedness and learning disorders as doppelgangers of each other. They're the exact opposite, the mirror image. So 85 on an IQ test of 100 is the mean, the average, right? 85 or less is considered rut-row, right, to use astro language. And anything less than 80 is considered learning disordered, which basically means you are two standard deviations below the average person in your same age and gender. Just like being gifted means you're two standard deviations above your age and gender norm peers. That's the definition. Okay? Now, if you're below 70, you are now what's called intellectually disabled, which is what used to be called mentally retarded. And then there's degrees of intellectual disabilities. You can have a weakness in an area and not be officially learning disordered, LD, right? So if you have, for example, let's say that you have verbal expression scores. So you take an achievement test. An IQ is an aptitude test. Think of aptitude as built-in RAM memory of the computer, okay? You can increase RAM memory. You can, if you juggle the computer and you break the RAM chips, you can decrease RAM memory, right? So IQ score is very variable, and the younger you measure it, the more unstable it is. It gets more stable as you get to your late teens and early 20s, but it's also dependent on things like, did you get enough sleep? Did you show up with a hangover? Were you uber pissed off or stressed out? Did you just get audited by the IRS? Did you get just beat up by a crowd on the way to taking the test? You know, did you just win the lottery? Did you, you know, did your wife just have a baby? Did your boyfriend just run off with Pedro the Bullfighter? Twisted version of Carmen, right? I mean, you know, it's dependent on mood and how much. What did you eat? Did you get too much sugar before you walked into the session? Right? Did you come in with a hangover? All those impact your brain's ability to process data, which means you're going to have a lower or higher IQ score depending on the mood you're in. Did you eat a shoot ton of protein before you showed up, bioavailable protein, and your brain's going, are you threatening me? So, I mean, it's really variable. And so you can have an IQ score, you get at 14, and at 20, your IQ may have changed. How much did you study? How much did you work on the areas that you were weak in that got measured by the first IQ test, okay? So IQ is RAM memory built in, what your computer able to do right here, right now. Achievement, right, is how are you allocating the RAM? And typically when you see a difference between IQ and achievement scores are a lot lower than the IQ is, measured IQ at that particular time, you're having what I call an OBF, an organic brain fart. And if it's bad enough, it falls under the learning disorder category. If it's not bad enough, if it's not 20 points or whatever, it's a weakness.
Okay.
So you really can tell where the allocation of the neural pathways are coming and what's working really well, what's working over time, and what's not working very well. And that's the beauty of this stuff, because you can see where a person has issues and where they're just kicking everybody else's patooties. And you really have to look at all the subscales of the IQ test. You can't just look at the IQ number, because IQ is like 17 numbers. And I tell people, always tell people, think of it like a pyramid. So the top of the pyramid is this thing we call a full-scale IQ score or full-scale index score, right? And now there's a 4 or 5 composite scores under that that average making up the full-scale IQ. Things like verbal comprehension, perceptual organization, working memory, processing speed, right? Those are made up of the individual subtests, the 3 to 5 individual subtests under each one of those composite domains that make up this thing we call working memory, right? So you could have a totally normal full-scale IQ. You could, let's say that you have an IQ score of 100, which is flat-ass average. And if you look at some of the subtests, you could have subtests that range from gifted to drooling, right? And you would never know that if all you knew was this general IQ score. It's very misleading, which is why you have to look at the subtest scores that make up the IQ and where the IQ is, and then what's the discrepancy between the composite scores, and the same thing with the achievement scores. So if you give an achievement battery, like let's say the Woodcock-Johnson, which is the one I use, but there are a lot of them out there that are good. And I give the entire Woodcock-Johnson, it's like 59 subtests. It's a major pain in the patootie, but it's very thorough, and I really love it.
Yeah.
I love the results I get from it. I don't like administering it so much, and people sure as hell don't like taking it. But anyway, and like the IQ score, it has composite scores and individual scores. And if you look at those, you can really see where do you have brain farts, where do you have brain neural pathways that are just kicking the heck out of everybody else, and where do you have stuff that's totally quote-unquote normal. And because the achievement scores are also normed on the same 90 to 110 scale, obviously, so you can compare apples to apples. And that's really what we're talking about. So what we're talking about in gifted is a person who has a substantially higher IQ than the average Joe or Jolene of that person's age and gender. And that's just cognitive processing. Now, can they use those IQ scores? You won't know that until you look at the achievement scores. And here's the other problem. If all they have is a high IQ and they're not very socially appropriate or don't have a lot of what I call social common sense, or they don't have a lot of emotional common sense, what you know Goleman will call emotional quotient, right, EQ, they're not going to do very well. And if you look at most of the research data, it clearly supports that the people who have a higher EQ and are better at social interpersonal stuff do a whole lot better than the folks who just have high IQ. That is no, first of all, it's no prophylaxis against psychopathology. And if you don't believe me, look at Ted Bundy and look at people like Kemper, the co-ed killer, who's got like 25 IQ points on me, and I've got a really high IQ. So, I mean, you know, that's why I tell all my patients, you know, what does a high IQ get you? The death sentence and life in prison if you don't have the EQ to back it up. So it's overrated. I mean, it's overrated. And I say that with a guy who has an IQ. It's overrated. I'm glad I have it, you know, and it's the reason I have 9,000 things after my name. But it's not the whole picture. And you'll get some people, for example, who have autism, right, who are on the spectrum, who have what I call real autism and not what used to be called Asperger's. And you get those people, and some of those folks have ridiculous gifts in areas that you're going, how the hell did that person get that? Right? And they are clearly, quote unquote, gifted in those areas, although if you measure their IQ, their IQ scores are in the dirt for the most part. You look at some ADHD people, and they have average or below average IQs, but they've got skill sets in certain areas, and 7% of the ADHD population have some form of executive functioning, abstract reasoning, which they're not supposed to have, which I call the bumblebee effect. So for folks who don't know the bumblebee's physics of the bumblebee's body, the bumblebee, it's really impossible from a aerodynamic perspective, it's impossible for a bumblebee to fly, but nobody told the bumblebee that, so it flies anyway, right? Go screw your aerodynamics. Well, that's what I call the 7% ADHD people, the 5 to 7% who have abstract reasoning. They're not supposed to have it, but nobody told them that. And those are the ADHD people who are typically successful. The other ones, not so much.
Gotcha.
You don't know jack about somebody if all you know is their IQ. You know that they're gifted, but how are they using are they lazy? Are they sitting on their gifted laurels not using their brain power? Well, that's not helping them. Are they using them for nefarious purposes? That's not good.
So I got a question for you.
Sure.
Several times in this last little explanation, you have mentioned that they measure your IQ against people of your age and gender. Why is it that they use gender?
Because some women are better, higher on some things than men are. Their brains are wired a little bit differently, and they have better skill sets in some areas than guys do, particularly at younger ages.
It's a biochemical thing that actually happens.
Yeah, it's a biochemical, logical wiring dilly. Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
They typically
better math. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. All righty.
And they mature earlier than guys in general.
Ooh, yes. Also true. Different average age of puberty probably enters into it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That is correct.
So, this is actually a good transition for the next thing that I want to talk about, because we're already touching on it, and that is the possible flaws and social biases in IQ testing, you know, things
right.
like culture norms, community norms, socioeconomic status. And a lot of these things probably affect the test because of the flaws that you pointed out earlier. You know, if they're using those things to measure it.
the socioeconomic status affects it because if you don't have the money, you don't go to school, you don't learn certain, you know, you don't go that far in school, or you get discouraged because you live in the ghettos or in the funky part of town, or your parents don't value education, and you get involved in gangs or drugs or whatever, and you're not learning stuff in school, you're not going to do well on an IQ test. Does that mean you're a dumbass? No, not necessarily. But if you don't know, how do you know? Right? And how are you going to know if you don't have, if that's not being reinforced, if education is not important in your culture or in your socioeconomic status, or if you're in a a religious group or a segment of the population that says women are not supposed to be educated, you're supposed to be home and learning house skills because guys are going to take care of you and you're going to be home and pregnant. You know, which still exists in certain parts of this country. You know, that's a third world country thing, but that's not the case.
Not necessarily.
Right, right. And let's say that you have a learning problem, a learning disability, or you have ADHD, and it doesn't get recognized. Now your brain is miswiring, and you're going to typically score lower on an IQ test. And you can't figure out why the heck. What's wrong with you? Because you're putting time in and you're doing this stuff and you're not getting it because your brain doesn't learn the same way another person's, a quote-unquote normal person's brain, you know, a standardized person's brain works. Well, that's true with gifted people too, which is why you see gifted kids often have a shoot ton of emotional problems, particularly the more gifted they are. Because here's the thing, if you look at the bell-shaped curve, that little tail that comes off the bell-shaped curve says how far afield from the norm you are. And when you get over about 125, 130, you're in the 99.9999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999 see the world in the same way that your age and gender norm peers do, which means you're going to be a weirdo, i.e. moi, right? And people aren't dumb. They know that other people are giving them dirty looks and like, what? When they make comments out of their mouth that they think everybody agrees with. And they look at you like you came off the battleship, you know, Galactica or something. And they are often ostracized because they're often, quote unquote, geeky or nerdy. They often have interests that aren't typical for their age and gender group. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in the same things their peer group is. They typically associate with older people, adults even. Mm-hmm. And I certainly did. I didn't feel comfortable with my peer group. So you'll see a lot of gifted kids with emotional problems. That's very typical. That's very normal. Yeah. Just like the autism spectrum kids have, because they get rejected. And some of the ADHD kids made fun of, and, oh, you're a loser, you're just dumb, you can't learn, blah, blah. Right, it's the same principle. Anybody who is not, quote, unquote, neurotypical, whatever your neurotypical dilly is, whatever version of that you are, right, if you're not normal, quote, unquote, you ain't right. And if you ain't right, you ain't one of us, right?
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, conform or recast out, to quote Rush, Subdivisions, one of my favorite songs.
Gotcha.
And that's why you see a lot of the ADHD the people and the autism spectrum people and the gifted kids all having problems. They hang out with different groups because they gravitate towards their own kind. You know, it's like water seeks its own level.
Yeah.
Well, neuroatypical people seek their, you know, own level of similar neuroatypical persons, right? Mm-hmm. And the rest of the world just thinks they're weird. And they catch a lot of flack from that.
What I want to do here is go ahead and jump to the third section, because you're touching around the edges of it. And we're getting a little bit close to the top of the hour, so I want to make sure we got time for this.
Sure.
So the next thing I want to talk about, and this is a related segue, the prevalence of ADHD or ASD in gifted persons versus neurotypical gifted awkwardness. You know, you were just talking about being different. And the NIH study that I didn't include it in the script because, honestly, it was kind of pedantic. And it's an excellent study, but it's really, really crunchy. But one of the things I pulled out of there was the fact that there is not a lot of codified, vetted research about people who have ADHD or people who have ASD, or especially people who have Asperger's, I'm including it because the DSM does, but under protest,
right,
as everyone
right,
knows,
right.
You know, that's tacitly understood. We don't agree with that decision, but I'm going to use it because that's what the study said.
Sure.
And
sure.
They mentioned that these things are not heavily researched and measured. And, you know, they should be, and they're sniffing around it, but there's not a lot of other studies. And so looking at these similarities is fairly new and not heavily researched yet. But where the meme was going and the points that brought this whole topic up is people were kind of getting into chicken and the egg about whether either of these pathologies tend to do things that make your IQ clock is higher. And I could see the propensity for this both in those who have what used to be called Asperger's and their pet topics, where they can have incredible levels of expertise and knowledge about stuff, can come across as giftedness or may even validly be giftedness. And then also mm-hmm. ADHD hyperfocus, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ability to really hone in on a topic and come up with amazing stuff because you just fall down that rabbit hole and you don't come out for
yeah,
hours.
That's called
and
perseveration.
Then you discover all the things. Oh, okay. So
yeah.
Relating
it,
to what you
said earlier
about the flaws
of their dopamine. Right, because
okay.
it jacks up their dopamine, and they have such a depletion of dopamine that anything jacks up their dopamine, they're on it like stink on a June bug. The problem is they can't stay on it because the newness wears off and the dopamine goes back down, and now they're bored and they're on to something else.
Gotcha. Okay, so it is not – basically, here's the point I wanted to make sure to examine tonight is that
okay.
it's not necessarily true – that either of these pathologies automatically make you clock as gifted. That's not
absolutely
that's not.
In fact, the reverse is usually true. I run into very few ADHD people who are gifted, very few, and even fewer autism spectrum people are gifted. Now, having just said that, the young man I tested just recently that I gave the results to yesterday had some amazing IQ scores, and he's ADHD as heck, had some amazing IQ scores like in the 120s and 130s in certain areas, achievement areas. I'm like, whoa. And I tested an autistic person who would have been labeled moderate to severe Asperger, as I like to call it, the disorder formerly known as. And
yeah.
this kid was gifted, and I'm like, you're not supposed to be able to do that, dude. Right? I mean, this was a kid who had eye contact, for example, which autism kids far and away don't do.
Struggle with. Yeah.
Right. He made great jokes. I mean, he was cracking jokes like nobody, and I'm like, and they were good jokes, not like mine. I mean, they were good jokes, right?
Yeah,
and I'm like, oh, my God, dude, you could go on the road with that shit, right? Super nice, super engaging, and I'm like, mm-hmm. what the hell, right? And got some very strong, had the LDs and the stuff that a lot of autism kids had, but really
yeah.
in some areas, he was just kicking patooties, and I'm just like, holy shoes. So you really don't know what you got until you do. Again, why I like the testing. Because if you were to say, oh, another ADHD kid, oh, my God, and oh, my God, another autism spectrum kid, and you roll your eyes and make all these assumptions, which I'm
mm-hmm.
sorry to say I'm guilty of doing from time to time. Both of these cases were great examples for me to wake up and smell a coffee because they could not be more atypical of their diagnostic group. And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is where
yeah.
being a weirdo is a good thing. Right? These guys were neuroatypical for their neuroatypicality.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Gotcha. Okay,
yeah.
And then so also conversely, if somebody does test as heavily gifted, it doesn't necessarily mean they have either pathology. That's also not an assumption.
That is correct.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
And but they could, you know, they're all of your uber, well, I shouldn't say this, a large portion of your uber successful antisocials, they have high IQs.
Yeah,
which is really,
which is frightening that tonight, because that's a whole topic on itself. I mean, you know, maybe
that's
we'll
really
that
frightening. But there's, if you look at the uber successful ones, and actually, here's an even more frightening thought. Okay, the really uber successful ones haven't been caught. We don't know who they are. These are the unsolved cold cases, right? With the oh my God, we've got this murderer who's been operating for 25 years, and we have no flipping clue who it is. And he or she's going up and down the East Coast to the West Coast. So they're, you know, we have all these unsolved cases. We can't put them together. Those are the uber smarties who have antisocial personality disorder, and you can bet your bippy they have high IQs. And they have good EQs because they're smart enough not to send letters to the press going, na 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 na, catch me if you can, and leaving all these signature marks to just do their business, get their jollies, and move on.
Yeah.
And that's a really frightening.
Okay. You know, this may turn into a topic for later on.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
So, all right, with that, we are getting close to the top of the hour. So at this point, is there anything else that you want to gesture at specifically that maybe we haven't touched on enough or not at all, whatever?
I just want to say one thing. Just because you have a low IQ, so to speak, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a loser and a failure. And just because you have a high IQ definitely does not mean you're going to be a success, right? It really depends on so many other factors, including drive, resiliency, determination, emotional stability, opportunities to succeed. You know, if you're in a culture that values that kind of thing and parents encourage their kids or whatever, you know, husbands encourage their wives or wives encourage their husbands or whatever. It's, you know, it's a lot of different factors. So don't bet on the racehorse that has a high IQ just because the racehorse has a high IQ. You're going to be wrong a lot of the time.
Yeah. Okay.
That horse is not going to always win the race. In fact, that horse may only win the race 50% of the time.
Yeah. Definitely. Okay. So that is very helpful because one of the things I talked about, you know, with my friend that mentioned the test earlier, and I think it may have been the Wexler she was referring to now that I stopped to think about it. We had kind of agreed that it was probable that with the tests that we have now, even with the better ones in the Stanford-Binet, you still have a thing where on the high end, you can't really pass that unless you have some ability, but on the other end, there's lots of things that you could not test very high on, but you do have ability, but it's the way that the test goes and what it's measuring, it can miss things. So
I'll give you a real quick example. So most of you probably know from previous shows, if you've listened to the show, my father had ADHD out of every body orifice he could possibly have. And let me tell you how bad it was.
Yes.
And it was so bad that he got asked to leave, and he was your typical conduct disordered kid who was doing all these crazy destructive things, and the school basically said, you know, take your kid out of the school, please, before we kill him. And his mom lied about his age and signed him into the military when he was too young, but she lied about it and signed him in. Because structure is a good thing for ADHD people. And I can tell you that my father did not have a high IQ. He was driven as hell and made a really good life for himself from a financial perspective. Unfortunately, he was also a narcissist, which made living with him a real pain in the patootie. But from a success perspective, he was extremely well respected in the community. He did very, very well financially and provided really, really well for me and for my mother. And if you had just looked at, he had barely a seventh grade education. So just because you have high school diploma and or college degree doesn't mean you're going to be successful. And so he had none of those things, but he was a never say die, driven like a mofo kind of guy, which is not typical of ADHD people, but it is of some. And this guy was one of them. Right. He was driven like a heart attack. And he was very successful, and nobody would have ever guess that. His family was not poor, was not wealthy. They were very poor. They lived in, substandard growing up, lived in, he grew up during the Depression, and his family got hit by the Depression. So he had everything going against him, and he made a lot of stuff out of what he had.
So this is good. So on behalf of Dr. Mathis and myself and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. And we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion. That'll be Wednesday, March 16th, 11 p.m. as always, Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. I want to give a quick shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. Travelitch Radio tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. For the first time in our 11-year run, Travelitch Radio journeys to Buffalo, New York, to find out what's happening on the American side of the Niagara Falls. Hear about the Western New York City's renaissance and historic legacy when Dan Schlossberg and Mariella Nugent-Lee interview Tina Kumiega of Explore Buffalo. On Saturday, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. This is hosted on StreamYard. Please check the NDB Media Facebook page for links and times. Sunday the 6th, coming up this weekend, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Please join me for the Walking Dead online viewing party. And we will be doing Season 11, Episode 11, Rogue Element. The synopsis is Eugene looks for Stephanie after she mysteriously goes missing. Connie investigates a story on Trooper Davis. And Carol helps Hornsby with a labor dispute at a drug farm. Monday Night in America with Roger Noriega. The following evening, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Roger Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history, currently also hosted on StreamYard. Check the page for links. Tuesday at 10 p.m., Fandom Access Week in Review. Join the TV tantrum of Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they digest another night of television. Please look for the Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us. See you soon, and rock on. Good night.